then Tuesday afternoon, then Wednesday, then Thursday. She was there, but she wouldn't see me. She fled the front room when I appeared the first few times, but then got used to it and just looked past me, as if the space I occupied were completely empty. I felt manipulated, but also heartbroken. I decided to go back to New York. I dropped off a long note to Jamie at her parents' house, where she was still staying. In it, I apologized again, apologized more, for the last week and also for the last half year, the last year, for every moment since I'd begun to change. I even wrote that, "I know it must seem that I've changed a lot since well before Mike's accident. I wish we could talk about it." We couldn't, though. That was the message she was giving me every day, the letter she wasn't writing back. I'd charged an open-ended ticket, maxing out my credit card for the first time. Late Thursday, I called to see if I could fly back the next day, but the earliest flight they had was at 6 a.m. Saturday. I booked it. My mother and I were cleaning up from dinner on Thursday when the phone rang. It was Rooster, asking if I wanted to go to lunch with him and Mike the next day. In the morning, I saw him back his old red Honda from the Nilsons' driveway, but when he arrived at noon to pick me up, he was driving a brand new blue one, and as I got in, I said, "What's going on here? Where's your car?" "I traded it in," he said with a bored shrug. "We're going to need a four-door for the baby." I felt my mouth fall open. "The baby?" He grinned. "Hey, there's a lot you don't know." Brenda's was a greasy little hole in the wall that I'd never really liked. It was the place Mike had gone with the guys. Brenda herself flipped the burgers, a round-faced woman in a flowered smock top. When the three of us arrived, she waved and slapped four patties on the grill. "Make it five today, Bren," Rooster called as he cleared space between the tightly packed tables so Mike could wheel his way to a clean one by the window. Rooster got up when the food was ready and brought it to the table. Mike ate more easily than I would have expected, with a clamping device Rooster helped strap to his forearm. When a little ketchup fell onto his lap, Rooster clearly saw it and just as clearly ignored it. They had their ways. We talked about Joan's pregnancy. Morning sickness was a myth. Joan felt sick all day. Rooster had heard the baby's heartbeat just yesterday, and it was amazing. After a while, the conversation turned to New York, and I told them about Parsons, how there might be a career in it for me someday. "And it's something you like to do," Mike said. "Yeah," Rooster said, "that makes a big difference." There was a gloomy little silence. I glanced back and forth between them. "What?" Mike frowned. "Nothing." I looked at Rooster, who shrugged. "Nothing it is," I said. Mike bent for a sip of his Coke. "It's that job I was telling you about, that computer job. I hate it." I turned to Rooster again, hoping for some kind of clarification, but before I could say anything, Mike was shouting at me, his face dark red. "What's your problem? Why are you looking at him? I'm the one talking, aren't I?" "I'm so sorry," I exclaimed, horrified. He stared at me for a long moment and then heaved a huge sigh. "No, I am," he said. "I am." I felt tense and ashamed. "It's boring," he said. I looked back and his eyes were sad, the gray of a winter sky at dusk. "Boring," I said. "Incredibly. And it gives me a headache. It's totally pointless. I mean, there's so much talk about being productive, leading an independent life. I'm a fucking quadriplegic." Rooster reached over and gave Mike's shoulder a pat. "You're not a fucking quadriplegic," he said quietly. Mike rolled his eyes and smiled a little. "Yeah, there's that, too." After we dropped him off, Rooster and I got back into his new car, and he drove me to my mother's, the two of us silent all the way. Out in front, he cut the engine. "I thought you didn't want to talk about him," I said. "I don't." "Well, let's anyway." "It's what it looks like," he said. "Believe it or not, it was a lot worse." He paused, then said, "My theory is that in the fall, there were a lot of things happening. There was rehab and getting the halo off and being discharged from the hospital and the wedding. And I was supposed to come home. And you were supposed to come home, but you didn't. And then January came and it was fucking cold, and Mike felt pretty hopeless, Carrie. Pretty stuck, like, well, this is it, welcome to life as a quad. I sighed and shook my head. Anyway, he started talking about wanting to die. What? I was confused. You mean he? Rooster said. I mean he wanted to die. And as I stared at him, I felt a great sorrow invade me. I buried my face in my hands. I kept thinking of Monday, the way Mike had looked for just a moment while the two of us were alone together, his pale face and his bristly mustache, and how his composure suddenly dropped away. He asked us for help, Rooster said. He asked me, he asked his parents, he even asked Joan once, to help him kill himself. I looked up. I wasn't tearful, I was past that. I was sick, blown apart. I guess I shouldn't have told you, Rooster said. No, you should have. I'm glad you did, or not glad, but, well, you know. He looked at me. Is it still going on? I said. Is that what happens on the bad days? He shook his head. He seems to have gotten beyond it. I mean, who knows what he's thinking about alone in bed at night, but he stopped talking about it, and you know what? That's almost enough for me. Isn't that awful? No. I think it's awful, but I can't help it. He started the car. Look, I've got to get back, he said. I'm sorry I dumped this on you, okay? And don't tell Mike I told you. Why not? He wouldn't want you to know. He doesn't want you to know. I mean it, Carrie. You can't ever say anything. Okay, fine, I said. But why? So if she does come back, I'll know it's not just pity. He stared at me. Get it? I didn't answer. His expectations are zero, Carrie, zero. But his hopes? This is a guy who has a lot to hope for, and you're somewhere near the top of the list. I canceled my flight. I couldn't go back yet, not after what Rooster had told me. Kilroy wasn't happy, and his unhappiness made me unhappy, and when I told my mother that I was going to stay a while longer, she searched my face hard, as if for an explanation. Do you really want to? She said at last. Yes. I called Mike the next morning and Mrs. Mayer answered. I said I guessed she'd heard I was back, and she said yes, she guessed she had. When Mike came on, I told him I was going to be staying for a few more days and that I'd like to visit if I could. They were all home when I got there, Mr. Mayer, Mrs. Mayer, John Jr. It was almost as if they'd hung around to get a glimpse of me. Or it struck me that way about John, anyway, who wandered in and out of the kitchen 4 or 5 times for no good reason. Mrs. Mayer was glacial. It was she who answered the door, and she held on tight, as if I might pry her away and try to force her into a hug. She looked older and dowdier, nearly a year into Mike's tragedy. Her hair badly permed, extra lines on her face. She wore a decade-old nylon sweatsuit, in a bright jade green that cast a gray light on her skin. She didn't bother trying to be nice. I stayed for about an hour. Mr. Mayer came into the kitchen tall and broad-shouldered, his bald spot gleaming. He looked at me, then he circled the table to stand behind me, putting a hand on each of my shoulders. "Isn't she a sight for sore eyes?" he said to Mike, and then he ruffled my hair and bent down to put the side of his face against mine. Monday morning I went to Fabrications. I half expected to be disappointed after the place in New York, but the shop still had its old hold on me, the fabrics not just gorgeous but arranged to entice, exquisite pale earth tones mixed with whites and ivories to signal the coming of spring. The bell over the door sounded, and a very tall woman came in carrying a Marshall Fields bag. She said hi to me, and I was confused for a moment, wondering if I knew her. But no, it was just Madison friendliness. I looked at my watch. Back in New York, my pattern-making class would start soon, and I was missing it again. Twice now. "Could you help me?" the customer said to the saleswoman, a soft-bodied blonde in an obviously homemade blue twill jumper with a lot of top stitching. "I bought this dress and I'm not sure what to do about the fit." The saleswoman showed her to the back room, and the woman came out a few minutes later, wearing a red silk dress that just didn't fit her, never mind what the color did to her face. As I watched, the two of them talked, trying to come up with a plan for altering it. "I think you'd have to take the sleeves off," the saleswoman said at one point. "Then you could take out the pleats and narrow it through here and get rid of that puffiness." The customer sighed. "I don't suppose you do any alterations," she said. "Sorry," the saleswoman said, shaking her head. "I have a 2-year-old at home." The customer gave her reflection a last look. She was turning toward the back room when I stepped forward and surprised myself by saying that I'd overheard her and that as it happened, I was in the business of doing alterations myself. "Are you really?" she said. "I desperately need this for Friday and I don't want to trust it to the tailor at the dry cleaners." The saleswoman said I could pin it right there, and we moved into a corner and got to work. I felt a little silly, but excited too, because I knew just what to do. Using pins from a box I bought on the spot, I took in the bodice, adjusted the sleeves so they were less puffy and droopy, and shortened the skirt by about an inch. "Look," I said, leading her back to the mirror, "isn't that better? If you can kind of ignore the pins and squint a little, you'll get the idea. I can't do anything about the hips but the rest." "I don't have to squint," she said. "It's great. You're a miracle worker. And don't feel bad about the hips. I've tried and tried, and I can't do anything about them either." The work was easy to complete by Friday, and the Kenmore held up for me, although there were a few bad moments when the bobbin thread got tangled and oily. I charged $60, and the woman and I were both happy. Heading back to her car after picking up the dress, she turned and said, "Hey, could you make me a dress from scratch sometime?" Standing there on my mother's front step, I knew the dress instantly. The neckline, the silhouette, the dusty blues and greens that would bring out her eyes and set off her hair. Just like that, in front of me, a whole dress. It was thrilling, and I shook my head regretfully. "Sorry," I said, "I'm just here visiting." Kilroy cooled. He went from a certain somewhat unhappy state of understanding to a more irritable state of wanting to know why I had to resolve everything at once, during a spur-of-the-moment trip that had gone on longer than planned. "You're getting sucked back in," he said. "You've got to see that you've done what you could. It took Jamie a long time to reach this point. It'll take her a long time to come back from it." I said I knew. I knew. I didn't mention that I'd stopped trying to see her. I didn't mention Mike. I visited him every day, just for a little while, a half hour, 45 minutes. He liked going for walks around the neighborhood on weekday afternoons when the sidewalks were empty. It was 60 degrees out, 65, and the tulips were opening, great stands of yellow and red. Mrs. Mayer barely tolerated me. She tossed me sidelong glares, her arms crossed over her chest. When I knocked on the door, she opened it and then walked away, calling, "Mike, door!" It was a punishment, and just. Enduring it was a form of mortification, as in mortifying the flesh to cleanse the soul, except that I was mortifying the soul to cleanse the soul. I survived it moment by moment. On Saturday, I showed up around 1. Mr. and Mrs. Mayer were in golf clothes, moving around the front of the house with clubs and shoes, and then going off to look for their gloves. She beckoned me to the side. "How long do you think you'll be staying today?" "I don't know, why?" She smoothed her skirt. "It's just John Jr. has a softball game, and I hate to leave him home alone too long. It's our first time out this spring, we only want to play 9 holes. She looked at me, our eyes truly meeting for the first time since my return. She gave me a faint, neutral smile. "No pressure." "Sure," I said. "No problem." She let out a heavy breath. "Oh, thanks, thanks." I joined Mike in the kitchen. When they were gone, I got us each some ice water, and we went out to the deck. "So, you're babysitting." "Mike." "Mom's a little too protective. I can hardly get her to go to the grocery store." A cardinal lit on the rail, and we watched it peck, then fly away. "Mike," I said after a while, "can we be friends?" He bent toward the redwood table for a sip of water, then straightened up and gazed into the middle distance. "I can't help loving you," he said, and his face slowly filled with color. "God, isn't that a line from some awful song?" "I think so. In answer to your question, he said. I really don't know. I want to be, I said. You don't even live here anymore, Carrie. I looked at my hands. How could I do both? Live in New York and be Mike's friend. Soon it was May 1st, and before heading out the door for the mayor's that day, I sat down and wrote Simon a check for the rent. I was down to a little over $300, and I was going to have to get a job as soon as I got back to New York. Temping, working at a library, something. I couldn't stand to think about how much money I'd wasted missing classes at Parsons. 11 as of today. Mrs. Mayer was waiting outside the house for me, her handbag looped over her wrist. I'd called and asked if she would show me how to use the van so I could take Mike out sometime, and though I'd meant the lift, she handed me the keys and said she wanted to see me drive first. I got in and she climbed in next to me. The gear shift rose up from the floor like a stiff plant. I'd never been behind the wheel of anything so high before, and I jerked out of the driveway a little roughly before heading up the street. At my side, she was silent, gazing out her window at the familiar sights. We drove around town for a while. Then she said I should go down to the Beltline. What were you thinking you might need the van for? I glanced over at her. She was staring straight ahead, both hands clamped on her purse. To go for lunch, I said. Or just out? She opened her purse, then snapped it closed again. How long are you staying? I'm not sure, maybe another week. I pictured Kilroy lying on his couch, his arms crossed over his chest, and I sighed. Mrs. Mayer opened her purse again and pulled out a lipstick. She lowered the visor, flipped open the mirror, and rolled color over her lips, a light coral. She recapped the lipstick with a smart click. Mr. Mayer and I have been parents for a long time, and it's strange, the things that bother you and the things that don't. I'll tell you this only once. We both feel that you are not reliable. We're both reluctant to have you back in Michael's life. My face burned. I stared at the road, the steady movement of the car ahead of me. Shall we turn around here? She said. You're doing very well. I never knew you were such a careful driver. I signaled to get off the Beltline. I stopped for a light and then drove back through town. Okay, she said once we were back in the driveway. I'll show you the lift now.
You're not coming back, Kilroy said. Are you?
I am.
You're not. You just don't know it yet.
We were on the phone again the day after my van lesson. I wanted to go back, but not yet. I wanted to be with him, but I wanted to be friends with Mike, to be there for him. But this was Kilroy. Of course I was going back.
Okay, when? He said. I want a date.
Something heavy tumbled through me. Silence fell along the line.
Sorry, he said.
No, I am. He laughed sharply.
What? That's a great dodge, isn't it? He elevated his voice to mimic me.
I'm sorry.
My heart thudded.
Just say, I said.
I twisted the phone cord around my finger, then slid it off.
I mean, I'm not saying this, but what if I did want to stay here? There are temp agencies here. You could come here.
No, I couldn't.
Why not?
Because I live in New York, he said in a tight, controlled voice. I want to live in New York.
More than you want to be with me?
Is that an ultimatum?
Didn't you just give me one?
We talked a little longer to no good effect. Afterward, I climbed the stairs and lay on my bed. I felt dizzy. I thought of his hands on my arms, how they were just the right size for my arms, his hands on my breasts. I put my own hands on my breasts, and they felt soft and flabby. They felt like nothing, like pockets of flesh. How extraordinary, I thought, that someone could touch you and make you into something. I took Mike out to lunch. Sandwiches one day, pizza another. In the van he was quiet, but once we were settled and eating, he grew animated. It was good to leave the mayor's house, their neighborhood. Sitting opposite me in a restaurant on Monroe Street one day, he looked across his pork chop, which he'd earlier asked me to cut into pieces for him, and said, Mike Mayer eats his lunch with gusto. I smiled. Mike Mayer does?
Yes, he does.
We split a cookie and then left the restaurant and headed toward the van. The afternoon sun felt good on my face, something clean about it, about the air. The sidewalk was empty, and I glanced in at shop windows as we went by. In one, a linen slip dress hung from a rack, and I paused. At my side, Mike stopped too. It was a nice grayed purple, some tiny crochet work along the straps.
"That'd look good on you," he said.
I looked down at him, and when our eyes met, a worried look came over his face.
"Should I not have said that?"
"No, it's fine."
"Are you sure?"
I nodded. Mike pressed the lever on his wheelchair and we started off again.
"Here we go," he said. "Mike Mayer takes Monroe Street."
Kilroy and I talked. Twice a day, every 2 days, it didn't matter. Being together required being together, and our conversations became grave and lugubrious. "I love you" was an idea that demanded physical proximity. Back in the fall, telling him about my life in Madison had been like handing him object after precious object to hold for safekeeping. Now I told him about seeing Mike, and it was like taking those objects back, one by one. I felt split in half. When I was with Mike, I thought of Kilroy. When I was on the phone with Kilroy, I thought of Mike. His hard time was late afternoon. He was tired by then, and his neck hurt, and he had to spend time in bed, lying on his side to avoid pressure sores from being in the wheelchair for too long. He could transfer himself with a board, incredibly slowly, incrementally, burdening his shoulders as he inched along. But on harder days, he let his mother move him. If I happened to be there, I watched while she planted her legs and went to work, silent with concentration, her face full of strain. Late one afternoon, he and I sat in his room together, right around the time he usually lay down. "Can I transfer you?" I said. I'd been meaning to ask, though I hadn't decided on today. "I think I know how."
"It's not about thinking," he said. "Believe me."
"What isn't?" I turned and there was Mrs. Mayer looking in on us. She did that a lot, poked her head in to ask if he needed anything. It was like the old days when she'd invent excuses to make sure we weren't having sex.
"Transferring me," Mike said. "Carrie offered to do it."
"She can't possibly," Mrs. Mayer exclaimed. "That's out of the question." She faced me with her mouth pressed into a thin line. "It's quite complicated. If you lose him for a second..."
"She wouldn't lose me," he said, rolling his eyes. "Obviously, she'd be careful."
"People have to be trained," she said. "It's a question of training."
"Then train her," he snapped. "Or better yet, why don't you both just get out of here and I'll do it myself."
"Oh, Mike," Mrs. Mayer said. "Oh, sweetheart." Her eyes were wide and I thought she would cry. I couldn't look at him, but I felt him off to my side, sitting in his chair, rage masked in his useless body. Then it was over. Mrs. Mayer came into the room and said, "All right, let's train her. Carrie, this is the best workout, you'll see." It was harder than it looked. The burden of his body was enormous. I knew I had to swivel him around, but I was terrified to move, terrified he'd knock me over. My arms were shaking. Finally, I just did it, swung us around until the bed was behind him, a dance of dead weight. I lowered him, and behind me, Mrs. Mayer sighed extravagantly. I stood there panting, then let his upper body down, our eyes meeting as his head touched the pillow. At last, I raised his legs and smoothed out the fabric of his pants so he wouldn't be lying on any creases. "Well," Mrs. Mayer said from behind me. "Well," she clapped her hands together as if dusting them off. "Be sure there's plenty of support under his head." Mike and I looked at each other. After a charged moment, we both laughed.
"Thanks," he said.
"You're quite welcome." The next afternoon, I learned that Mike had quit his computer job. He was tired of pretending it was more than just a way to feel useful.
"I'm not useful," he said, "and gathering data about fucking life expectancy rates isn't going to change that, or how I feel about it."
We were in the van together on the way home. I looked over at him, strapped into his wheelchair. His eyes drooped at the outside corners. Even his mustache drooped today, rimming the unhappy arc of his mouth. How'd your dad react? I said.
He was disappointed. Well, maybe not disappointed, he just wants you to be happy.
I think he'd settle for a little less than that. We rode along in silence. He said, Mom, on the other hand, was all for it. Why should you spend your time on something you hate when you don't need the money, dear? She'd be perfectly content to have me be like that Tom guy.
Mike, she wouldn't. Tom was a C3 he'd met who'd never breathe without a ventilator.
You know what I mean.
I knew. Mrs. Mayer wanted Mike to count on her no matter what. She didn't always see how hard it was that he had to.
He's a head on a pillow, Mike blurted. If that were me, I'd rather be dead.
I braked and turned to face him.
Mike.
I would. He looked at me defiantly, and my first impulse was to look away, brush it off, bury it.
You didn't say that, but he had.
Will you... I hesitated.
Will you tell me more?
Immediately, I felt my face fill with heat.
Tell me.
Kilroy's phrase. After a while, Mike sighed and began to speak.
I read somewhere that after something like this, you spend your life either looking for a reason or looking for a cure. But you know what? There isn't a reason, and there isn't a cure. There just isn't. I went to this church thing a few times, and it was crazy. It was like all these people were just dying to have me decide that God had a plan for me. Why would that make a difference? I think I stopped really believing in God around the same time I stopped believing in Santa Claus, and if breaking my neck was supposed to help me start believing again, why on earth would that be a comforting idea?
He shook his head. My therapist says maybe the hardest challenge is having to live with suicidal thoughts, having to accept them as part of the whole damn package. He stared at me. Are you going to take me home or not? I took my foot off the brake and drove the rest of the way to the Mayer's. At the driveway, I eased up the bump and stopped in front of the garage. I cut the engine. My heart was pounding. I said, Do you have suicidal thoughts a lot? He looked at me and looked away.
I did. I mean, I still do, but not as much.
That must be... I searched for what to say. That must be hard. He sighed.
It's exhausting. It's like you have these pictures in your mind, and you're pulled toward them at the same time you're trying like hell to stay away from them.
Mike, I said softly. God. He looked away.
After a while, he said, I'm ready to go in now. And I climbed down from the van and went around to the other side, then stood waiting while the lift lowered him. I walked up the ramp behind him, his wheelchair humming. At the top, we stopped.
Want to sit out here for a while? I said. Would you like something to drink?
No, thanks.
Neither of us spoke. I leaned against the railing. Mrs. Mayer was in the kitchen, her shape as she moved around just visible through the clean windows.
Mike Mayer has a morose spell, he said, glancing at me and smiling a little. He sits in his wheelchair and contemplates the back lawn.
One afternoon, I stood hesitating at the top of the mayor's basement stairs. I could hear the dryer pounding, smell detergent, and heated cotton. Mike was in his room resting, and I started down, wishing there was something to knock on. This was Mrs. Mayer's domain. She was standing at a long table, a huge basket of laundry at her feet. In front of her, everything was in neat stacks. Socks sorted, shirts folded just so.
Excuse me, I said.
She looked up and frowned a little.
Oh, hi.
I continued down the stairs until I'd reached the concrete floor. Can I talk to you about next weekend? She pursed her lips. Memorial Day was nearly upon us. Memorial Day itself, the first anniversary of Mike's accident, but also Memorial Day weekend, which she and Mr. Mayer traditionally spent up in Door County at an annual conference put on by his office.
What about it? She said.
It's already decided. I'm not going.
I know, I said, but Mike really wants you to.
What are you getting at, Carrie?
I'd like to stay for the weekend so you can go. I'll come on Friday and stay till you get back Tuesday morning. You can tell me everything I need to know. I'll be responsible.
Her mouth tightened.
I want to do it, I said. You can hate me for the rest of your life, but that doesn't change the fact that I'm here now. I'm back, and I want to be part of Mike's life, and I'm going to be.
Carrie Bell, she said. Well, well. She smiled a little. Mr. Mayor does want me to go.
Then go, I said. I went over on the Friday afternoon. I baked a meatloaf Mrs. Mayer had left and put out a salad that was already in the bowl and needed only to be dressed. John had a friend over, and the four of us ate in the kitchen, the little countertop TV turned to a baseball game on ESPN. John was already deep in training for his senior year hockey season, and he had 3 helpings of meatloaf and at least a quart of milk. Saturday morning after breakfast, we sat in the kitchen waiting for the doorbell. Mike's attendant was due to arrive at 9 to help him shower and go to the bathroom, administer his BP, as Mrs. Mayer said, his bowel program. I sat on the deck while they were busy. Finally, Mike wheeled outside, his hair still wet, a sheepish smile on his lips. Remember when BP stood for beautiful people, he said? The times, they have changed. We got into the van and drove over to the state capitol. The farmer's market at the end of May. There were tender lettuces, spears of rhubarb, tiny carrots and potatoes. We joined the crowd circling the stands. I bought some potted herbs and a jar of honey for my mother. A farm wife with worn-out fingers sold us a massive bear claw, and I tore off little bits and fed them to Mike, then licked the almondy crumbs from my fingertips. Monday was Memorial Day. We hadn't made plans, and I woke early, impelled to come up with some activity. Shopping, a park, a movie, something to get us past the middle of the day. Mike had other ideas. He rolled into the kitchen where I was cleaning up and said, casually as you please, that he wanted to drive up to Clausen's Reservoir. He watched me nonchalantly, waiting for my response. My heart pounded. How could he go and not come back a little more broken? How could I? He sat there in his chair, face still pink from his shower, his mustache newly trimmed. He'd been waiting for this, I understood, for a long time. There was a lot of traffic. We drove past farms and small clusters of houses, interchanges where narrow roads ran to rural towns. The parking lot at the reservoir was crowded, lots of jeeps and motorcycles. Fool's wheels, as Mike and Rooster had always said. I pulled into a handicapped spot and cut the engine. Out the window I looked at the hill that hid the water from view, grassy and choked with Queen Anne's lace. What do you want to do? I said. The path up the hill was narrow and rocky. It was not accessible.
Get out, at least.
I got down and went around to help him. He pushed the lever on his chair and began to move forward.
We'll get a pop, he said.
The refreshment stand was at the far side of the parking lot. By the time we got there, Mike was sweating. He looked unwell. We drank the sodas under the bright shade of the plastic shelter, neither of us saying much. When we were done, Mike asked me to get some hot dogs, and I stood in line again, thinking he didn't want the dogs so much as he wasn't ready to leave. Finally, we started back toward the van. When we arrived at the path over the hill, Mike stopped. He wheeled around so he could look at me.
The helicopter landed right there, I said, pointing at the clear space where the road led into the parking lot. You were still on the pier, where Rooster had pulled you up.
What were you thinking? Mike said.
That it was my fault? That if I hadn't been mad at you, I would have kept you from diving?
Oh, Carrie,
he said.
Oh, Mike.
Oh, everyone.
That evening after we watched TV, we went into his room and I unbuttoned his shirt. He got it off and transferred onto his bed, where I eased the shorts down, rolling him from side to side to get them off.
All set? I said.
He slept in his underwear, the catheter tube running down his leg to the collection bag.
Yeah, I'm fine. I was wondering, though, he hesitated, would you go put on your pajamas and come sit with me? Just like a proper slumber party. For our last night.
I went up to Julie's room where I was staying. I'd brought a short flowered nightgown, a giant t-shirt, really, and I got undressed and put it on.
I tapped lightly on the door as I went back into his room. I sat in the armchair near his bed. He said, "If I asked you to do something, would you do it?"
"What?"
He looked embarrassed.
"I wish you'd take your nightgown off. I want to see something."
I stood up. He watched soberly from the bed, a little furrow in his forehead. I reached for the hem of my nightgown. It wasn't cold, but my arms were covered with goosebumps and I hesitated, not wanting to go on. At last I pulled the nightgown over my head and dropped it on the chair behind me. I was in my underwear. I crossed my arms over my breasts and then let them fall again. My nipples puckered. I didn't know what to do with my hands, how to hold them. I clasped them together in front of me, then wiped them against my thighs to dry them. Mike stared. Just stared. Absolutely nothing visible on his face but the subtlest tightening of his chin.
"I feel a little weird," I said at last,
and he sighed and looked away.
"It's okay," he said. "I'm sorry, you can get dressed again. I felt nothing, that's what I wanted to know, and I felt nothing."
I pulled the nightgown back over my head. Nothing. To have your sexual self frozen, locked away. It was almost easier to imagine my limbs without motion. He was staring at the wall. After a while, he lowered the head of his bed until he was flat on his back.
"There," he said.
I went over to the side of the bed. He met my eyes with his, then looked away. It was a narrow bed, perhaps a little wider than a regulation twin.
"Can I sit here for a minute?" I said.
"Yeah." I sat down. The blanket scratched the backs of my legs, and I shifted my weight and pulled my nightgown further under me. My back was to him, and I twisted partway around so that my thigh lay parallel to his body, and I could look back and see his face. Across the room, a poster of Lake Mendota hung in its silvery frame. It had been photographed from somewhere near the Union, Picnic Point curving in from the left. I closed my eyes and tried to remember our little place there, the room made by trees where we'd first made love. He coughed.
"Are you comfortable?" I said. "Should I go upstairs now?"
"No, stay," he said. "Stay with me a little longer." I nodded. The night was so quiet I could hear the faint thumb of a moth lighting on the window screen. "There," Mike said. And he lay there. And I sat. My mother's house was quiet, sliced into sections of dark and light by the afternoon sun. I turned down Mrs. Mayer's offer of a lift home, and I was sweating lightly from the walk, my shoulders sore from where the strap of my bag had pressed into it. A large cardboard box sat under the oak desk where my mother kept mail and things. Tossing my bag toward the bottom of the stairs, I knelt by the box and saw my name in big magic marker letters. The return address was in a ballpoint scrawl, 188 West 18th, New York, New York, 10019. All on one line, like code for something. Kilroy. I got a knife from the kitchen and pulled the box out from under the desk. I cut it open, and there was my Bernina. My Bernina, sent to me by Kilroy. He'd packed it carefully, with foam blocks in the corners to hold it tight. Not an inch of give for movement, breakage. There was no note, just the machine. I went into my mother's bedroom to use the phone. It was 6 New York time, and he answered on the first ring. I said, "I thought I was going to... I would have..." And he said, "I figured you'd want it." Then neither of us spoke for hours. Weeks. I held the phone loosely, but my palm grew slick anyway, and I had to pass the receiver from hand to hand. "I feel terrible," I said at last.
"For whom?"
"Kilroy," I said. I hesitated a moment, then said, "For me. For you, for us."
"So you've destroyed me," he said.
"No."
"Maybe you have. The thing is, you really don't know. You'll never know."
"Kilroy," I said, "please don't do this."
"Do what?"
I was silent. I knew this was a front, that he was terribly hurt. But to say so would hurt him more. I said, "You know, I really meant it when I said you could come here." And I really meant it when I said I couldn't. Another silence, and I felt myself move toward crying. I pulled back. It wouldn't be right to cry. It wouldn't be fair. It would suggest I thought I was feeling more than he was, when I knew I wasn't. "It sort of reminds me of Lemmings," he said. "What?" "The idea of my going to Madison." I thought of lemmings, those little rodents that committed mass suicide in Norway, or somewhere, running headlong off cliffs because all the other ones were. "Actually, it turns out lemmings aren't trying to die," he said. "Did you know this? They're blind or something, they just don't know what's up ahead." I felt impatient. Only Kilroy could turn a breakup conversation into a disquisition on suicidal rodents. "I once knew someone who thought lemmings were people," he went on. It was like he'd missed the part about them being 2 inches long or whatever, and only tuned in on the big run off the cliff. "That's terrible," he said. "Why doesn't someone try to stop them?" He laughed, and I joined in a little half-heartedly. "Who was that?" I asked idly, not caring, certainly not expecting an answer.
"My brother."
"What?"
I felt queasy. "I didn't know you had a brother." Dread gathered along the edges of my body, ready to invade. "I don't anymore," he said. "My brother? He did. That's from Heart of Darkness, you know. Mr. Kurtz? He did. You've read Heart of Darkness, haven't you?" I lowered myself onto my mother's bed and began to tremble, sick with confusion, disbelief, rage. "Kilroy." I felt as if the bed were moving, and I put a hand out to steady myself. "You're telling me this now?"
"What a coincidence."
"Kilroy, my God. When? How old was he? How old were you?"
"He was 21. I was 26.
It happened 14 years ago. On March 20th. That weekend, meeting his parents, they'd wanted him to stop by because of the anniversary. Was that why we'd gone to Montauk that weekend? To avoid his mother's card.
He had leukemia, Kilroy said. He'd had it on and off since he was 10.
Kilroy, I said, I'm so sorry to hear about this. I wish you'd told me before. He snorted. What was his name?
What difference does it make? He snapped. Then he softened. You wouldn't believe me anyway.
What do you mean?
His name was Mike, he laughed. Seriously? Isn't it all so crystal clear now? Isn't it just too perfect? Two people, each on the run from a tragedy named Mike. Cry or puke, take your pick.
I cried, sobbing and sobbing, while he stayed silent on the other end of the line. I couldn't believe it. Couldn't believe it. And yet I'd known, hadn't I? That something was missing. That in knowing him, I hadn't really known him.
Carrie, he said. I'm going to hang up now.
Don't, I cried. Please, we need to talk more.
I am, he said.
Live well, okay? And then there was the dial tone. I collapsed onto my mother's bed and wept harder, my shoulders heaving. I had been happy with him. I'd loved him. I loved him still. I could get on a plane and fly back tonight, to New York, the bustle and thrill of it, the noise, the smells, to Kilroy. I could use the key I still had to let myself into his apartment. If he was already asleep, I'd undress quietly and get into bed with him. He'd feel me, smell my smell, and then gradually wake to my return. I imagine how we'd come together without speaking, our bodies at the forefront, making the first connection. But Mike wheeling onto the deck after his shower, Saturday morning, saying, "The times, they have changed." He was rueful now. Changed, like the times. "Mike Mayer has a morose spell." He was rueful, and deeper inside himself, looking out, looking in. Was a person an accumulation of past selves, or made new over and over again? I wanted to keep knowing him. to see where he went next. I thought of the September night I left Madison, heading through the darkness until I saw the sun rising over Lake Michigan, adrenaline keeping me going, adrenaline and coffee in despair. Isn't it all so crystal clear now? Isn't it just too perfect? Two people, each on the run from a tragedy named Mike. It was true. I turned Mike into a tragedy named Mike, and run from it, from him. I thought of yesterday at Clausen's Reservoir, how I'd known what he wanted to hear, about the helicopter, the wait. There was so much more for me to tell him, for him to tell me. I went out for a walk. The afternoon light hung late in the sky, and I walked fast, seeking the strain in my muscles, the faint searing in my lungs that would tell me I was moving. On the Fletcher's block, someone was getting ready to barbecue. I smelled lighter fluid and burning briquettes, the scent nostalgic and sustaining. As I walked, the smell got stronger. At the head of the Fletcher's driveway, I understood they were barbecuing. Mr. Fletcher and some assortment of his daughters. Mrs. Fletcher was still in the hospital, and Jamie, I knew from my mother, had more or less moved home. Just like me. I made my way along the house, stopping at the low gate into the yard. On the brick patio, a black Weber grill threw smoke into the sky. The screen door of the mud room swung out, and Bill appeared on the porch, a platter of meat in hand. He caught the door with his foot just as it was about to clap shut. Then he came down the steps and stopped at the barbecue, all without noticing me. He set the platter on the picnic table, then suddenly he looked over his shoulder. "Geez, sneak up on a person, why don't you?" He hesitated, then came over to the fence. After a moment, we hugged clumsily, the gate between us. "Fancy seeing you here," Bill said. "It's called living dangerously," I said. "Steak for two?" "About." We stood there. The last time I'd seen Bill had been at the hospital, a week or so before I'd left. "How is Jamie?" "Okay, she's actually doing a lot better." "Than before?" "Well, I better go." I lifted a hand to wave. "I'm glad I saw you. Maybe I'll run into you again one of these days." I turned to go. I was past Mrs. Fletcher's station wagon when he called my name. I looked back and he motioned for me. "Try again," he said in a low voice when I was close. "Okay? I can understand how you wouldn't want to, but, well, she misses you. I see it all the time." I breathed in deeply. I waved again and made my way back out to the sidewalk. It was dusk now, and I walked back to my mother's, where I sat at my desk. I vaguely remembered there being some stationery in the bottom drawer, and when I opened it, I felt myself smile at the sight. A box of Snoopy stationery Jamie'd given me for my birthday in third grade. I took a piece out and saw that there was only one more left, and that someone had written on it, "Happy birthday to you, happy birthday to you. You look like a monkey and you smell like one too." "I'm just kidding. Dear Carrie, happy birthday. You're my best friend. Love and kisses from Jamie." I set the page on my desk and uncapped a pen. I sat there thinking for a long time, and then I wrote this just under Jamie's loopy third grade signature. "It's true, I smell like a monkey, even to myself. Can I tell you one last time how sorry I am? Apologetic, yes, but even more to the point, just sorry for what you've gone through. I used to imagine us growing old together, or not growing old, but being old, sitting on the porch of some nursing home in matching rockers and reminiscing about our teen years. Even once I was with Mike, I never pictured anyone but the two of us, and I didn't picture us sick either, just wrinkled and white-haired and laughing about the time we tried to do our math homework by breaking potato chips into fractions and arranging them into equations on your bedroom floor. I'm back for real, and what I know is this. Carrie minus Jamie equals too much loss." I folded the page, put it in a Snoopy envelope, and walked back to the Fletchers. The barbecue smell was gone, and I put the letter in the mailbox and walked home again in the sudden dark. My mother was in the kitchen when I arrived. I told her a little about the weekend at the mayor's. Neither of us had eaten, and we made a big salad and carried our plates out onto the back porch. It was completely dark outside the circle of light cast by the dim porch fixture.
"Did you have a feeling he was going to leave?" I said.
"My father. Were there any hints, or did it just happen out of the blue?"
She set her plate onto the porch floor.
"I thought he was going to explode," she said at last.
"You mean do something violent?"
"No, I mean I actually had a recurring image of his head literally exploding, which was probably the closest I could come to wanting to kill him. So in answer to your question, I don't think I had a feeling he was going to leave, but it didn't happen out of the blue either. He had a lot of momentum going." I put my glass down.
"Were you horribly lonely?"
"Not really. More relieved. Hugely relieved, in fact. And of course, really angry, too. I had you, though, and that's what mattered." I looked at my hands. She'd had me, but only until she hadn't. I remembered all those dinners at the mayor's, all those weekend afternoons. Thanksgivings when I took her with me, Christmases when I wanted to go but didn't. I looked across the porch at her taut chin, the still young contours of her face. She had something in common with Kilroy, the possibility of spending Christmas alone with nothing for company but a big book. And something else, a kind of stillness in the face of being left. She had friends, she had her work, but in some essential way the important thing had already happened to her. I was back, yes, but I didn't ever want to feel that way, that there was nothing new up ahead.
"Are you lonely now?"
She looked over at me, my mother in her burgundy linen work dress. She shook her head.
"Lonely is a funny thing," she said slowly. "It's almost like another person. After a while, it'll keep you company if you'll let it."
I sat at the dining room table, the morning sun shining onto my sewing machine. It was a week since my conversation with Kilroy. I'd called the woman whose dress I'd altered, and we'd met at Fabrications, where I'd steered her to a lovely cornflower blue silk. I'd drawn her away from the dowdy shape she wanted, instead resurrecting the vision I'd had weeks earlier when she picked up the red silk dress I'd altered for her. A boat neck top over a flared skirt, just right for her narrow-shouldered height. I'd had her buy a couple of patterns, but I was using them more as a starting place than anything else. I had my experience at Parsons to help, although I also felt that I'd left it behind, a bright flag receding in the distance. I was working on the cutting line when the doorbell rang at a little after 11. Jamie was on the doorstep, blonde hair hanging by her face, a pink tank top showing her pale shoulders. It would sound better to say we both burst into tears, that we fell into each other's arms right there. But in fact, it was very awkward, the two of us with our arms folded across our chests, standing outside and then standing in the kitchen and finally sitting down, glasses of iced tea gripped in our trembly hands. We talked in the way of two people with something enormous and impossible to speak of. We talked about movies, the weather, a new CD she wondered if I'd heard. Gradually, I relaxed. I realized we didn't have to say everything that morning, or soon, or ever. She stayed for half an hour, exactly, as if she'd decided in advance. Standing to leave, she asked if I'd like to come for dinner some night. "We'd take turns cooking," she said. I said I'd like to. Walking to the front door, I said, "Are you going to stay home for a while?" She nodded. "How is she?"
"She came home for a visit last weekend. It was like having this very polite house guest."
After Jamie left, I called Mike and suggested lunch, then cleaned up the dining room and headed over. He was on the deck waiting, tennis hat firmly on his head. We'd been eating a lot of ethnic food, or as ethnic as it got in Madison, enchiladas and pad thai. Today he suggested the Union Terrace. We drove over and I found an easy parking place right on Langdon. Graduation was over and summer school hadn't started yet. We went out to the lake and took the ramp up to the terrace. Mike waited at a shady table while I went inside for deli sandwiches. Back outside, I sat next to him, both of us facing the lake. I put a straw in his iced tea and positioned it near the edge of the table so he could bend over for a drink. He swallowed and looked over at me. "Dirk and Ann called yesterday. He said they could use some help.
He said I could start with 20 hours a week and then see.
Dirk Nan was his old boss at the bank, and I tried to contain my excitement. Mike could go on and on about the uselessness of trying to be useful, but I thought going back to the bank would be the best possible thing for him.
Are you going to?
He made a face. I thought I'd never go back there. It's so out there. Meet the public. But I realized the main thing I wouldn't be able to do is shake hands with people.
Which doesn't matter.
He looked at me, something stirring way back behind his eyes. It does matter. But it's not the end of the world. I looked across the water, and there was Picnic Point, a finger of land pointing into the lake. I remembered Stu's story of walking across the ice with Mike and Rooster, and I imagined Mike out there, as he took step after dangerous step in the drifting chill of a December night. Mike took a deep breath and then sighed.
"Can I ask you something?" he said.
"Of course." He looked down and colored slightly, then looked up again and his eyes met mine.
"Are you back to stay?"
"Yes," I said, but my throat felt funny, and it came out hoarse and scratchy, hardly even a word. I said it again.
"Yes."
He smiled a complicated, inward-looking smile of warring emotions quieted, if only for the time being.
"So you're what, going to fly back for your car?"
"I sold it," I said. He sucked in his cheek and nodded.
"Oh, that makes sense. It must be hard to park in New York."
"I needed the money. You can't imagine how expensive it is to live there." He scowled a little.
"Yes, I can."
I felt Mike's eyes on me and wondered what he could see, if I had "Kilroy was here" written on me somewhere in a tiny hurried scrawl. Of course I did, just as Kilroy had "Carrie was here" on him, where it would stay whether he tried to rub it away or not. He was a map of messages, read by no one. I'd felt them with my fingertips, but they'd been hieroglyphic, indecipherable. My left hand was resting on the edge of the table and Mike looked down at it, at my ring, his ring, our ring, which I'd been wearing all this time. Our eyes met.
"Hock it if you want," he said.
"I would never." I twisted the ring around my finger, then took it off and put it on my right hand and held it out for him to see.
"It's a friendship ring now."
"How'd that happen?"
"It just did. Presto changeo."
I smiled at him.
"The ring. It has changed."
"If you say so."
"I do," I said, and then I realized what I'd said.
"I do." And our eyes met again and we both laughed, awkwardly at first and then happily, chortling together over a joke only the two of us could fully appreciate. A bit later, we went back to the van. Instead of heading for the mayor's, I turned the other way and drove up past the observatory, then swooped down toward the hospital and past it. By the time I'd parked, he had to know what I had in mind, but he didn't say anything. I cut the engine and helped him out. The path was wide and smooth, and we moved side by side through deep shade and into spots dappled by sunlight. How tall the trees were, making it an expedition by green tunnel, unseen water on both sides. For a while, Kilroy was there too, walking a pace or two behind us. I wanted the anguish I felt to stay with me. Knowing it would fade was the saddest thing in the world. I kept looking over my shoulder, but saw only the path, running back the way we'd come, winding through the trees. 6 weeks later, I would get a postcard that I'd know only by inference came from him, blank but for my name and address. The photograph showed a sunny field of lavender in front of a row of silvery trees. "A hillside in Provence," it said on the back in three languages, and in the ink ring that canceled the French stamp, the word Var. That was still ahead of me, though. Today, Mike and I moved along the path. The little clearing off to the left, where we'd lain on my beach towel. We passed it, neither of us commenting. It had been there long before we had. A songbird trilled from high in a tree. A little later, Mike looked up at me. "We never would have gotten married, would we?"
I reached over and pulled a glossy leaf from a bush we were passing. I ran my finger across the surface, then let it fall. "I don't know," I said. It was beginning to seem like maybe not the best idea. "I think I know why," he said. "It was like we already were married. We'd gone too far." I nodded. We would say more about it later. Both of us. For now, I looked around. At the trees. At the sky high above. I breathed in the clean smell of pine. The path grew shadier and twisted to the right, then to the left again. "Here we are," he said. And we entered the final sun-filled clearing, the water pale blue and all around us, visible between the limbs of trees. He stopped moving and smiled up at me. "Well, what do you know?" he said. "Mike Mayer returns to Picnic Point." This is Scarlett Johansson. We hope you have enjoyed this production of The Dive from Clawson's Pier by Ann Packer. This program was produced and directed by Lauren Krenzel, executive producer Sherry Huber, abridgment by Lynn Lauber. Text copyright 2002 by Ann Packer. Production copyright 2002, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.